Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 93, section 10, which is old single column, page 1024. Okay, final section in this opening paper of the block on Melchizedek. They want to give us a little epilogue about a very distinct individual now in the local universe of Nebadon, one mock event of Melchizedek. And then we'll get into the first doings of the Melchizedek missionaries that they want to tell us about. I don't think there's much else to say, other than we've wrapped up the whole story of what Melchizedek did while he was in the flesh, while he was incarnated, and the immediate consequences with Abraham and everything. So, as I said, they just want to give us a little epilogue on Machiavelli himself. So let's just jump in, see what they have to say.
10. Present status of Machiavelli Melchizedek. During the years of Machiavelli's incarnation, the Urantia Melchizedek receivers functioned as 11. When Machiavelli considered that his mission as an emergency son was finished, he signalized this fact to his 11 associates, and they immediately made ready the technique whereby he was to be released from the flesh and safely restored to his original Melchizedek status. And on the third day after his disappearance from Salem, he appeared among his 11 fellows of the Urantia assignment and resumed his interrupted career as one of the planetary receivers of 606 of Satania.
Okay, so the first thing, just notice kind of littered throughout that entire paragraph, They're speaking a little bit more to this mystery, this question that we pondered a bit. I mean, just exactly how much intimacy does he have with the other 11 receivers? And you can see that they really just are talking about him as if he is not appropriately called a receiver during those years that he's incarnated. He's in that different a mode, even though we don't quite know what it means to be a receiver, what all the duties are and whatnot, it's pretty obvious that he's not in some sort of intimate 12-foldness, see with them doing their receivership stuff. He's really on a totally separate track. And as they'll be talking about, once he's been incarnated, he can't go back identically as he was before. You know, when they say he resumed his interrupted career as one of the planetary receivers, yeah, but now he's kind of a Melchizedek in quotes. He's not a pure Melchizedek anymore. And so even functioning as one of the 12 receivers again, he's going to bring a perspective, and who knows, maybe even literally an energy nature or something, that's different than what it was before.
Just like Michael.
Just like our Creator Son after he was incarnated. So, and they don't give us, much to speculate on with any specificity, but nonetheless, right, I mean, you can just remind yourself of those technical details.
The receiver scouted for his students?
You'll see here, I think it's maybe the next paragraph, a little hint about what kind of a relationship the receivers had with the efforts to keep going what Machiavelli started up.
Curious how you got there. All the students that were needed to travel the whole
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll talk about that a little bit. Yeah, when we read a little bit more, because there's some questions there we can address. Let's see what else. There was something else there. Let's see, what was it?
I'll ask a question.
Okay, go ahead.
Everything's always on the third day.
Oh, yeah, that's what it was. I knew that's what it was. That was the other thing I was going to bring up. I knew there was another little thing I wanted to comment on there. There's an unexplained mystery. Okay, now here, the first thing we need to say is because all that they're doing is localized. Okay, this is literally the third day. Okay, and we've talked about this some before. I mean, remember, this is not 3 days later. This is the third day. Okay, so there's the day he de-incarnated and the day he was back in play, and then the whole day in the middle. Right, just like with the resurrection of Jesus, since there's no transport required, in that middle period, it's literally 3 days. Most of the time when they're talking about our resurrection, even if it were third circlers or greater, and it's going to happen, immediately. They'll metaphorically, speak of it, or kind of, quote unquote, in truth, you could say, speak of it as on the third day. But remember, there's a couple times when they want to be technical and remind you, okay, you've got a long transport journey in the middle there. So, it's more precisely called the third period, the technical sort of scientific issues aside, why three, whether it's 3 days or three periods or whatever? When you say three periods, it's like, it's kind of like us writing a story. There's a beginning, a middle, and an end. There's obviously the day you die and the day you're resurrected and then whatever the chunk is in the middle. So when it's three periods, it's not really that mysterious. But the fact that when there's no transport required, why is it that that middle period is literally a day? Okay, and they never explain that mystery. It's not just because someone loves the number three or something. There's got to be some literal physics to this, something to do with, the way a planet is encircuited and the natural cycle it has because of its rotation period. There are some things that are very literal like that they occasionally hint at. You've got angels coming and going, transport, seraphim, for instance, coming and going, synchronized to the day, to midnight and noon. But that's, But that's because, you've got the sun, right, to deal with, and you don't want, they don't want to launch and have to go through the sun. But, this is another matter. Do you have a thought?
I think it has to do with the adjuster, because he had an adjuster, and the adjuster is responsible for the soul.
Yeah.
And I think
right. I mean, there's those issues, but and we'll talk about those issues in a second. So before I kind of comment on that, let me table that too. As soon as we get a little bit more red, we want to talk about some of those details about how this works with Machaventa. And then we'll revisit, whether or not that says anything about this on the third day. But nonetheless, even if we don't sort out the physics of it,
didn't the Jews allow 3 days for the soul to
Right. I mean, you see, that's the thing. There's, you could say it has to do with, you know, human traditions, okay, but you know it's more than that. I mean, they're not just doing this for our sake, you know, because we had a fixation with the number three historically. You know there's got to be some literal physics to it. But
they couldn't go through the sun or something.
Yeah, I mean, there's with the transport seraphim, you don't want to, you know, launch from the earth, you know, where you go blasting off and, you know, and you're going right at the sun, you know, so you you leave when you're going the opposite direction from the sun. You know, I mean, there's some simple, you know, solar system geography things for transport seraphim, but no one's being transported or anything. This is all just right here. Right? See, so it must have to do with something with the physics of it. But I was about to say, you know, right at the end there, I mean, even if we don't figure out the physics of it, at the very least, should remind you that there's nothing arbitrary in the universe. Everything, you can ask why about everything. I mean, there's some definitive physics reason, you know, why things are done. I mean, no one is being arbitrary. And, you know, and there's an order to everything because the universe is inherently logical. Everything has laws that govern it, you know, and those laws just are. So even if you can't figure out the specifics, you know, it should remind you of that, you know, that no one is, especially if you still have some hesitancy about your survival after death or something. I mean, you know, what if someone kind of forgets about me and I get lost in the bureaucratic shuffle or something? It's like, no, I mean, everything is very precisely, you know, seen to so you don't have to fret. Yep.
During this time, he was without a body. And so what is he? I mean, there's his personality. There's his new soul.
Well, no. I mean, you know, he's not without a body. You know, so we'll get. I don't want to open that up. That's the what I'm delaying is talking about that stuff because that's coming up. So let's just wait a second and we'll talk about some of those details in a little bit more here in a second. So let's go ahead and read some more.
Makiventa terminated his bestowal as a creature of flesh and blood, just as suddenly and unceremoniously as he had begun it. Neither his appearance nor departure were accompanied by any unusual announcements or demonstration. Neither resurrection roll call nor ending of planetary dispensation marked his appearance on Urantia. His was an emergency bestowal. But Makiventa did not end his sojourn in the flesh of human beings until he had been duly released by the Father Melchizedek and had been informed that his emergency bestowal had received the approval of the chief executive of Nebadon, Gabriel of Salvington.
Okay, so before we get to these questions that I was putting off there temporarily, let's just note the one additional little issue that they're bringing here at the end. I thought it would be fun to just go back and, you know, and read a couple sentences to you to remind you about why we're talking about the Father Melchizedek and Gabriel here. Way back there in paper 35, when they introduce the Father Melchizedek, they give you a little statement about the relationship between the Father Melchizedek and Gabriel. They say the following. In the universe of Nebadon, the Father Melchizedek acts as the first executive associate of the bright and morning star. Gabriel is occupied more with universe policies, Melchizedek with practical procedures. So policy, kind of the thought sort of mode for Gabriel, practical procedures for Father Melchizedek, sort of the word, you know, there's the thought, word, action. You know, they're part of a triplet, along with Nambia, the chief of the life carriers. Okay, but you know, you've got this twofold executive of considering it relative to policy and considering it relative to procedure. See, and both are weighing in. Right, the Father Melchizedek, is duly releasing him. So you know, he's saying, okay, you've met all the practical procedural requirements here. You've done what you needed to do, and you know, and it's had policy approval above that from Gabriel. Okay, so that's what's going on. More of that, like we were talking about with the physics of why 3 days and stuff. I mean, everything is all very precisely, every I is dotted and every T is crossed, okay, with the administration. Okay, now, the first part of that paragraph. Okay, so he terminated his bestowal in flesh and blood just as suddenly and unceremoniously as it had began. There wasn't, you know, and as they're saying there wasn't anything fancy about it, no announcements, you know, no incredible light show or something, or, you know, see, no demonstration. So it's, you know, it's all just behind the scenes physics of handling this. You know, no one is, you know, is like fusing, you know, and needs to be lifted up into the atmosphere. It's all very straightforward. Okay, so let's try to think about that straightforward process. Like Gloria was saying, we got to remember that he has an adjuster. You know, unlike if he just manifested physically. Right, this incarnation thing is, you know, makes him so he's in a mode where he's not just corporeal, but he's can be and needs to be adjuster indwelt. So there's a spiritualized adjutant mind in juxtaposition with a thought adjuster. There's a super additive consequence. There's a soul that's produced by that adjuster. Now, for us, like Gloria was saying, I mean, okay, for us, our soul, you know, is very much a separate object. You know, it's this completely. The soul itself.
Call it a construct.
But that construct is a literal object. Okay, I mean, that soul is an object that an angel, a guardian angel, can take possession of. Okay, and now the reason why just saying object, you know, doesn't tell the whole story is, you know, while my soul right now is not just that kind of Marantia brain, just that Marantia substance object, there's Marantia mind seated on that actual Marantia structure construct. Okay, so there's a whole mindal self there that is completely separate from the adjuster's mindal self and my adjutant mindal self. There's three mindal selves. Is our Melchizedeks, when they incarnate, like, are they just like that? Well, maybe. But one could also wonder if maybe it's a little bit different. Because, see, you know, we're separate because there's a whole developmental process that Marantia self has to go through before it finally gets to fusion and fuses with a thought adjuster.
I just remembered something.
Yeah?
Melchizedek doesn't go on after his mortal life.
Right. That's
what you're looking at. Those adjusters that do, like they mention on some worlds, mm-hmm. The adjusters have experienced and may go on,
right.
And they carry that with them.
Right. See, that's, you know, that's the thing.
Like
I was just about to say. See, he's very different. You know, in that, you know, his soul is not going to fuse with that adjuster. Right? That adjuster's going on, and we know, that adjuster is not going to fuse with anyone's soul. I mean, that adjuster became personalized by the Father eventually. Okay, but you've got a different situation. It's not like you have this very embryonic soul like we have, and it's got this long developmental process, and eventually it fuses with the adjuster. Think about it. Because it's not going to do that. If that soul was literally this other object, how does that stay associated with Machaventa? Once the adjuster leaves, he's been deincarnated and the adjuster leaves. I mean, as long as the adjuster is there, remember, the adjuster is not just plugged into your mind. The adjuster is plugged into your soul. I mean, that's kind of why your soul stays with your adjutant mind, right? The two are kept co-located because of the adjuster is attached to both of them, okay? So, I mean, you see, you're thinking about it, it's like, wow, that just sounds kind of weird. With our process, think about our whole process. Eventually that your soul will fuse with that adjuster, but that's just fusion. That's just, you can kind of picture it as, its surface glues to the soul surface glues the adjuster's surface. And throughout your local universe career, your soul infuses more and more until, right, it's not like two things glued to each other. They're totally incorporated together, and you leave as a first stage spirit. So wouldn't it make more sense if what's happening is that soul that adjuster is producing is just already incorporated into Melchizedek's nature while he's incarnated, right? It's infused at the same time that's being made. And it's like, well, maybe, but think about it. There's another reason why it seems like that could be possible. That adjuster's nature, I mean, that Melchizedek's nature is, they can morph their energy, right, to be basically any kind of an energy expression of local universe beings, right? It can directly relate to Marantia substance. They already, just by what, the kind of energy body he has. So that's my guess, that's my suspicion, is that, there's not going to be some fusion with it. With Michael, it was different. Michael has a part of him called his fusion spirit, and his soul fuses with that fusion spirit and all this sort of thing. They give you some of those details. Here, I'll bet you it's just being incorporated into his nature actively while it's, being generated by the adjuster. And so there really isn't a third self, see, with him. It's just his one self is just being augmented during his incarnated life. That's my guess. I mean, again, I can't prove that, but that's kind of my suspicion about what's going on here.
Melchizedek has a universe mind, and it says that the infinite spirit bestows a mind on war creatures. And the reason he had to become mortal was he had to operate through what the average
right.
human mind.
Right, like we talked about.
That's why he needed an adjuster.
Mm-hmm.
Any time that happens, then an adjuster enters in.
Yeah, and it's bringing up his mind. This is one of the fascinating things to think about with an incarnate. I mean, you have a similar thing with the prince's staff. That Machaventa, while he's incarnated, he had adjutant mind. But he also still has access to that mindedness, that local universe mind flavor of mind that, you know, Melchizedek is normally plugged into, you know, is plugged into, not him. You know, they're there at the same time. You know, it, with a prince's staff, you have to have Marantia mind and adjutant mind kind of together in the same self there. And you go, well, that seems a little weird. Not that weird. Remember, they tell you a secondary midwayer is like that. A secondary midwayer, with just one mindal self, has the sixth and seventh adjutant, so it has some adjutant mind, and it has Marantia mind. See, like the prince's staff would. So, see, with a Melchizedek, you've got a similar sort of two minds as one sort of going on. You got kind of the lowest mind and you know, some of the highest mind in the local universe. So, again, it sort of would supply a context for there to be this Marantia mind brought into play with him, you know, as this soul, you know, develops within his energy nature too, and he has even more of a vertical spectrum of mind. That's my suspicion of what's probably going on.
Could you say that advocate mind is interchangeable as creature mind?
Yeah, I mean, if by creature you mean material creatures or. The way it works is, the way you kind of think about it is, if you take the sevenfold adjutant mind and you go up the mind hierarchy, it kind of comes together as one mind, which is Marantia mind or like angel mind that's kind of at the same level. You sort of have just whole spectrum of mind, you know, and it's sort of just where you're plugging into it. You know, and how unified it is. The higher you're higher up you go in the local universe mind energy system, the more unified that mind energy is. His natural Melchizedek mind is even more unified than Marantia mind. You know, for instance, because it's mind engaging a more homogeneous seat than the heterogeneous warp woof, you know, seat that Marantia mind is engaging to. So, you know, it's just one facet, but it obviously has to have some differential in it to match up with the differential of physical and spiritual energy. That if you don't have that, that mind doesn't have to have that kind of differential in it. It's more unified. Anyway, that's just, you know, that's some speculations. There was something you were bringing in that we're going to talk about too.
Well, yeah. What I'm seeing is the mindal self is a far more, I hate to use the word substantial because mind isn't substance.
Right.
But there seems like there's a substantial element to a mindal self.
You got to think very literally about a mindal self, yes. Yeah, and just remember, there's a reason why the dictionary doesn't have the word mindal in it. It just has mental. To the degree to which humans haven't rejected mind, and are materialists, past reflective thinkers, we're basically recognizing the aspect of your literal mind that's called mind activity. You know, and that's kind of what the word mentality is referring to, is the mind activity of your mind. But there's not just mind activity. Underneath that, kind of all the more literal, like you're saying, is the mind energy itself. When you want to remind, when the Revelators want to remind us to not just think kind of ethereally about mentality, you know, they coin and use the word mindal, right? You know, there's a literal mind energy. You know, there's not just the mentality. And, it's a literal stuff. It's not a substance-like stuff that you can build bodies out of. but it's literal. You've got to kind of just, you know, keep that in mind. Pardon the pun.
There was a period when Jesus was about 17. He worked on his mind.
Yeah, I mean, but yeah, it's just what Gene was just kind of, it was sinking in for him. Jesus, you know, was working on his mind, you know, thinking of his mind in very literal terms, not some fuzzy abstraction, right? But, you know, it's a, just as you need to work literally on your vegetable garden, okay, you have to work literally on your mind. Yeah, the degree to which that sinks in, its literalness, it's helpful to get at, you know, some of the reference, like Laurie was saying, about what Jesus was doing. But just beyond that, I mean, what the revelators are encouraging you to do in various places in the book, right? To picture it literally. Okay, let's see, anything else? Oh, just one quick little thing. You know, like we've pointed out, you see how they're reminding you this is not a dispensational revelation with Machaventa Melchizedek. It's an emergency one. Notice how they stress that over and over again, which I've already done. Okay, keep going.
Machaventa Melchizedek continued to take a great interest in the affairs of the descendants of those men who had believed in his teachings when he was in the flesh. But the progeny of Abraham through Isaac, as intermarried with the Kenites, were the only line which long continued to nourish any clear concept of the Salem teachings.
Okay, so remember, you know, Abraham had concubines, you know, and so there were other lineages. But it's just the status wife, Sarah, and her son Isaac, that produced an interplay, you know, through intermarriage, like they're saying, with that kind of better philosophic parallel stream that Machaventa spun up with the Kenites, you know, which made it so that Abraham's progeny, you know, in that one lineage, held on a little bit better to the actual Melchizedek teachings, instead of just a kind of immediately it having it melt into whatever flavor of the ghost cult framework, you know, a particular tribe had. And then the other thing, you know, Gloria was asking about, Machaventa continued to take a great interest in the affairs of the descendants, and of course the other 11 receivers are with him on that, That's why you have so many genuine prophets, not just people that were delusionally called prophets, but genuine prophets amongst that, the descendants of Abraham. Those receivers are frequently engaging those, you know, select individuals out of that lineage. Giving a little bit of tweaking to try to help them to stay focused as best they can on what Machaventa said. You know, like just monotheism itself, for instance. And because there's all this, all the people around are trying to suck them out into polytheism again. Right? There's just, you know, zillions of deities, quote unquote, all around them, you know, that are, you know, clamoring for their attention. So, remember how I told you that when it's a Melchizedek, they give a quote unquote first name to, like Machaventa? That's one of the receivers. And, one of those, his name, I won't go into the details right now, but just when you unpack the etymology of one of those names, you discover it's actually related to this engagement. Speaking to this you know, active engagement to make prophets, you know, as it were, to make tweaked people. Okay, so it was, you know, not only did they take great interest, there was great activity, exceptional activity centered upon that lineage to try to keep blowing on the embers, you know, as best they could. But don't forget, like they tell you, you know, in another spot, despite all of this great interest and all of that exceptional effort, if it wasn't for the 6th century BC, you know, and you know, the whole, the individuality of the whole, you know, supremacy sort of stepping in and having a spiritual quickening, their efforts would have been to no avail. So,
but that didn't happen. So,
right?
Does it give any indication at all how long before he met Abraham he was present getting his?
They don't give you precisely, but it's obviously, you know, a few decades. You know, it's at least a decade. You know, and probably a little bit more, just based upon what they say. Yeah, so he was kind of well established, remember, before Abraham got in the picture. Yeah, you know, so maybe something like that. Yeah, yeah. He was there for 94. You know, so.
Left while Abraham was still alive.
Yeah, yeah.
It was an extended time.
Yeah. You know, Abraham would have been relatively young when he first got in contact with him. Okay, let's keep going.
This same Melchizedek continued to collaborate throughout the 19 succeeding centuries with the many prophets and seers, thus endeavoring to keep alive the truths of Salem until the fullness of the time for Michael's appearance on earth.
See, I already jumped the gun on that one. See, went ahead and combined it with the foreshadowing of it in the preceding paragraph. Yeah, they, like I said, they collaborated extensively, and it's obvious Machaventa is taking the lead because he has the most intimate understanding of exactly how to engage them. You know, even if it wasn't him, you know, that directly engaged, you know, Ezekiel, say, or something, you know, it was one of his fellow receivers, you know, he was directing the show on how to go about that and whatnot. You know, he took the lead on it.
Were the earlier prophets killed, or did they manage to survive?
It's a mixed story, you know. I mean, because they're almost always prophets of doom, you know, sort of, you know, so they're not accepted very well.
Jesus said in the last discourse that
he killed all the prophets, and right, yep, exactly.
I wonder why
he didn't do anything. Well, yeah, I mean, that's kind of, you know, they're not allowed to intervene, you know, arbitrarily. They need to let lives play out, you know, basically. You know, I'm sure part of the approval from Gabriel was the ongoing, you know, 19 centuries of, you know, just how much they could engage. He would have gotten approval from Father Melchizedek and Gabriel. I mean, the 12 receivers got approval on those details, I'm sure, because it's exceptional. I mean, that, you know, that's not normal for, you know, for them to be so micromanaging like that. So, but again, it's all because this is going to be Michael's bestowal world. So, you know, it's Michael set the stage for that exceptional sort of action. Right? I mean, you know, I mean, the other Melchizedek receivers on the other rebellion worlds, you know, wouldn't have been doing this sort of stuff because they weren't trying to keep things going for Michael to show up on that world.
Yeah, but they prepared for the magisterial
son. They would be doing what they could to prepare for the magisterial son. Yeah, yeah. But it's just not as intense. You know, because a magisterial son is a gentler step up than trying to have something in play for a bestowal son, you know, to engage. Okay. Remember that we started at 1980 BC. All right. So, you know, there's all those centuries from, you know, basically 1900 BC, you know, and until 7 BC or thereabouts, you know, for them to be working. So, you know, remember, technically, they didn't leave until Mount Hermon, so it's not like they left at 7 BC. You know, so you've got like, not, you know, full, basically 19 centuries there that they're engaging things. All right, let's keep going.
Machiaventa continued as a planetary receiver up to the times of the triumph of Michael on Urantia. Subsequently, he was attached to the Urantia service on Jerusalem as one of the 4 and 20 directors, only just recently having been elevated to the position of personal ambassador on Jerusalem of the Creator Sun, bearing the title Vicegerent Planetary Prince of Urantia. It is our belief that as long as Urantia remains an inhabited planet, Machiaventa Melchizedek will not be fully returned to the duties of his order of sonship, but will remain, speaking in the terms of time, forever a planetary minister representing Christ Michael.
Okay, so you've got this, you know, their comment about just recently. You know, they never give you a specific year, but it's obvious that somewhere in the beginning years of the 20th century is when he was given that vicegerent title, vicegerent planetary prince, and as you're reading there, and you go, wait a minute. It is our belief that as long as Urantia remains an inhabited planet, is that in question? It's like, no, you keep reading. The word is forever. All right. I mean, you know, you'll see as they say some more things here, like it's often the case, the revelators are humble to a fault at times, you know, in not presuming when they speak about things. You know, they'll kind of admit at the same time that, you know, all the best minds everywhere have thought about it, and no one can think of any other possibility but X. You know, so everyone is pretty darn certain X is what's going to, you know, be the case. But, you know, they occasionally want to remind you that no matter how high a being chimes in with an opinion, you know, the especially the ends of supremacy are inescapably shrouded in mystery. There's always the possibility, you know, no one was predicting the appearance of Magistan, right, for instance. Right? There's, you know, and there's, you know, countless other things, you know.
And there was the brief activity of the Supreme and the outer space.
Right, there's all those things, right? So they occasionally, you know, will say, okay, if you want to be really precise, okay, none of us can say absolutely certain, you know, because none of us are absolute beings. You know, and so they'll speak very humbly. But right there, you can say, okay, see, technically, you know, any given world could some have some sort of thing befall it where it doesn't become part of eternity. Okay, but we're talking about Michael's world here. And so they say forever, right? All right. I mean, it's so, you know, make sure you don't get caught up in them speaking about a technicality, you know, in contrast to what is actually going to happen. You know, everyone knows that Michael's world is, you know, is a part of things. But even then, even in that forever sense, they know that they can only speak of the finite age, right? In terms of time, forever. Right? I mean, no one has any idea what's going to become of all the material objects you know, when we all transcend the finite. I mean, you know, no one has a clue. I mean, there could be just a complete transformation of everything. So, but at least as long as the finite age is in play, as time, not transcended time, is concerned, right, it's not going anywhere, right? If they have to bring in every master physical controller in existence, they will keep it secure, right? No supernova or some oddity is going to make this planet, you know, go away. You can be guaranteed of that. Oh, here, just 1 second. You got a question back here first. Yeah.
I'm wondering about this vice-chairant planetary prince.
Yeah.
So, for all practical purposes, he's now planetary prince, is he not? But it must be qualified.
Right, he's the title, right? I mean, Michael holds the title. Michael is technically, you know, the planetary prince. But, you know, Michael is not actively exercising that role, but neither is Machaventa. You know, he just has this new title, vicegerent, and they're about to talk about, okay, with that title, what various things could happen. You know, and so they're going to give us, you know, all of their endless speculations, and you can pick between, you know, amongst them, you know, your favorite speculation about what's going to happen.
No child,
but
no
parents. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Well, you're going to say something, yeah.
And just somewhere in the Urantia book, if a world, it doesn't say if a world has survival value or not, but what happens is they interpret the sun.
Right. Well, yeah, there's that. I mean, worlds that are part of a lasting phenomenon.
And
that,
then
yeah.
Somewhere in the Urantia yep. book, they're talking about trillions of years.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, right. Yeah, definitely. Okay. Did we get everything there? I think we got everything there. Because, like I said, let's, yeah, we're going to talk a whole bunch more about vicegerent and all that sort of stuff. Let's just keep going, yeah. Oh.
As his was an emergency bestowal on Urantia, it does not appear from the records what Machaventa's future may be. It may develop that the Melchizedek Corps of Nebadon have sustained the permanent loss of one of their number. Recent rulings handed down from the Most Highs of Adentia, and later confirmed by the Ancients of Days of Urversa, strongly suggest that this bestowal Melchizedek is destined to take the place of the fallen planetary prince, Caligastia. If our conjectures in this respect are correct, it is altogether possible that Machaventa Melchizedek may again appear in person on Urantia, and in some modified manner resume the role of the dethroned planetary prince, or else appear on Earth to function as vicegerent planetary prince, representing Christ Michael, who now actually holds the title of Planetary Prince of Urantia. While it is far from clear to us as to what Machaventa's destiny may be, nevertheless, events which have so recently taken place strongly suggest that the foregoing conjectures are probably not far from the truth.
See, could you speak in more endlessly qualified fashion? Yeah. But you notice that they're... setting aside, it's like, well, but in the end, who knows? All signs point to he's going to become the planetary prince, right? Barring the deep mysteries of supremacy, he's going to become the planetary prince. And like I was saying before, when we were talking about his soul is incorporated into his energy nature now, I mean, technically, they already have lost one of the Melchizedeks. He just isn't really a Melchizedek anymore, in the same way that our Creator Son is not a Creator Son anymore, right? He's a Master Son. He has different deity and different, bottom-up experiential nature incorporated into him. He's not the same being anymore. It's just, there isn't sort of a separate name that they coin for us for these modified Melchizedeks, like they give you Master Son instead of Creator Son. But he's definitely a Melchizedek with an asterisk, Right. I mean, definitely. Yeah. And then the cool thing is, you know, when you talk about him possibly, most likely, being planetary prince, unlike a normal planetary prince that's invisible, you know, throughout his whole time as planetary prince, you know, he could come visibly.
I felt the presence of Jesus a couple of times, once at Mum's house, and I wonder if the planetary prince has a presence kind of like Jesus.
And you know, he could have that kind of transcendent sort of relationship and presence, or he could go all the way, you know, and just manifest himself corporeally as the planetary prince. And it's like, well, why would he do that? Well, that's kind of the next paragraph. I'm sure he still has that ability to modify his energy nature, and he could manifest, you know, corporeally if he wanted to.
But that limit his ability to, with the receivers, he was only able to communicate with the receivers.
No, that's when he was incarnated. See, he wouldn't be incarnated again.
No.
He would just manifest physically. Mm-hmm. And see, one of the reasons you kind of see as they continue to speculate, I mean, one of the reasons he might do that is, you know, like a normal planetary prince, it's okay for him to be invisible because he has a visible staff, a corporeal staff. Maybe he's not going to have a corporeal staff. And he wouldn't need to be if he was corporeal and maybe had some other corporeal beings here with him. Okay? So you see, it's this kind of stuff that you can speculate on. Yeah, you got something too?
Well, if he does come corporeally, we'll be sure to recognize him by his breastplate.
Now, whether or not he wears the breastplate again, who knows? But anyway, let's see what else they expect. Oh, you got something too? Yeah.
Well, I'm curious. They mentioned recent rulings twice here.
Yeah.
So these recent rulings,
right?
Which is kind of interesting, make you think they probably are rulings having to do with Lucifer
rebellion,
right? He's going to be out of here pretty soon.
Well, remember that the thing directly they tell you about that, you know, you assume is probably at the same time as his vicegerent status being given is rounding up Satan. Remember, and not letting him roam the rebel worlds anymore. You know, that is happening. You know, maybe at the same time or close. Are close to the same time.
Wasn't that when Jesus saw Satan?
No. Well, that was alluding to that.
Didn't they make a prison world?
Yeah, there's a prison world that Lucifer has been on since Pentecost. But Satan has been continuing to go around the rebel worlds until just somewhere right at the beginning of the 20th century. Right? Like what they're alluding to here, these recent rulings, right? And remember the deal with that is, I saw Satan, that reference. If you have it so that, before Satan was rounded up, remember, if you blur Lucifer, Satan, and Kaligasha kind of all together, right? You know, you sort of have the mode where the devil, quote unquote, is roaming free in heaven, and then after that, when Satan can't do that, and all you have is Kaligasha, it's like he's been thrown down to earth, and is only on the earth. See, so there's kind of a spirit of validity to those notions of him being cast down, quote unquote.
Remember, he was cast out of the council, too.
Right, yeah, there's all that stuff of being cast out of the councils and all those sorts of things, too.
But in the arrangement, when we entered the era of light and life, one of the things they do is inaugurate a translation chamber.
Oh, yeah, right, yeah.
Where you can actually
Yeah. There's right there. There's those. So yeah, like I said, for most of the time though, the prince is not visible. Yeah, I mean, eventually you've got beings. You know, the mortals, are kind of like Adam and Eve and can see all the lower spiritual beings and stuff. Remember, we talked about that. But yeah, for most of the time, you've got a completely invisible planetary prince. Yeah, and
he had invisible whatever.
Yeah. So anyway, let's read this next paragraph, see, and you'll see where the idea of, you know, him maybe being corporeal, you know, how you can play with that.
We well understand how, by his triumph on Urantia, Michael became the successor of both Caligastia and Adam, how he became the planetary prince of peace and the second Adam. And now we behold the conferring upon this Melchizedek the title vicegerent planetary prince of Urantia. Will he also be constituted vicegerent material son of Urantia? Or is there a possibility that an unexpected and unprecedented event is to take place, the sometime return to the planet of Adam and Eve, or the certain of their progeny as representatives of Michael, with the titles vicegerents of the second Adam of Urantia?
Right. So there's, you know, lots of possibilities, but, you know, if you say, well, okay, I'm going to start with, I don't think Adam and Eve or any of those children that were taken off and are on a denture right now, I don't think any of them are going to come back. You could start with that kind of simplest assumption. And I think it's just going to be Machaventa, and he's going to manifest corporeally, and he kind of can be much more literally taking the role of also the material son as well as the planetary prince, not in terms of biologic uplifter, but in terms of direct facilitator to handling genetic engineering and eugenics and stuff, you know, like Adam and Eve were supposed to, that kind of genetic, you know, assistant. Now, but you could also say, okay, but doesn't he need some sort of staff? Well, you know, maybe those progeny, you know, of Adam and Eve, you know, could be brought back as his staff. And again, you know, they can't procreate. They're not, it's not going to be biologic uplifter, but, you know, they could help as staff, you know.
One of the things that makes this an abnormal world from all normal world is we're lacking the representation of immortality. And when immortality is represented, it connects you from the material to the Urantia, and that's missing here.
Yeah,
and somehow they have to make that up, and because they do more than just govern. I mean, it keeps civilization and records and all kinds of things for the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As well as
school. Right. See, and that's another reason why, you know, you'd like to speculate that at least Machaventa would manifest corporeally. So he's this very direct representation of immortality, you know, for everyone to see, like you're saying. And other material beings, you know, that are immortal, helping out with that, you know, too, possibly. But it's all speculation.
Like they're a visible grid.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And see, that's
yeah, it is, and I agree. I mean, it you know, that's not, you know. That has definite significance on every world to have that visible, you know, kind of conceptual bridge to help people to link here to the next life more. So, yeah, all those things are in play. I mean, not to mention who knows, like we were saying, who knows what all like receivers are doing, you know, that they don't even talk about. You know, what do all these normal dispensational beings do that isn't so immediately related to us and hence of interest to us? You know, what about the whole spiritual economy of the planet and all sorts of things? I mean, who knows what all has to go on? But anyway, there's lots of possibilities here.
Unexpected and unprecedented. Didn't we leave that in the dust a long time ago?
Yeah. Right. We have a very exceptional world. you know, remember, even if there had been no rebellion and no default, it would have been an exceptional world because we're a decimal world. And kind of an exceptional decimal world at that, right? So there's lots of wild cards to this planet, and they're just kind of reminding you of all that. And they're not done reminding you of all that.
Sorry, what did you mean about leaving it in the dust rage?
It's been unprecedented for layers and layers.
Yeah, I mean, we've been dealing with unexpected and unprecedented for a long time on this planet.
I'm expecting more of that, so I didn't want it to be left in the dust.
I mean, you know, malignant bacteria and viruses are unexpected. And so, I mean, there's just no end to the, whoa, okay, that's different. You know, there's just so many things about this world.
The thing about it is we're young as a human species. Like, I would say we're about 7 or 8 years old chronologically.
We are very young, yeah.
As a species, that's where the hope lies.
Yep. All right, so let's get it. They've got more speculation and stuff to throw out here.
And all of these speculations associated with the certainty of future appearances of both magisterial and Trinity teacher sons, in conjunction with the explicit promise of the Creator Son to return sometime, make Urantia a planet of future uncertainty and render it one of the most interesting and intriguing spheres in all the universe of Nebadon. It is altogether possible that in some future age, when Urantia is approaching the era of light and life, after the affairs of the Lucifer Rebellion and the Caligastia Secession have been finally adjudicated, we may witness the presence on Urantia simultaneously of Machiaventa, Adam, Eve, and Christ Michael, as well as either a magisterial son or even Trinity teacher sons.
It's like you feel like you should tell the author, okay, you need to go take a cold shower. Yeah. You're getting kind of worked up there, dude. Yeah. But it is, you know. I mean, and as I pointed out, I mean, you know, it's not just that. I mean, it seems like this world is a perfect world to have one of the completely unrevealed orders of sonship show up here. Something that's not even mentioned in the Urantia book. I mean, really, you know, there's no end to the speculation of what could happen on this world.
Chris,
yep.
Can we come back to experience this with them? Is it a possibility?
It's always a possibility, but most likely you'll be, you know, way down the road working on other things. There's that unanswered question of just how much nostalgia goes with you, you know, as you ascend.
Well, probably where you came from.
But
you can, because, you know, they have all kinds of universe broadcasts. By that time, yeah, we're going to be re-encircuited into that. So, you know, that kind of stuff, because it's so unique, as you said, it's so interesting.
Yeah.
I'm sure that
you'll definitely be able to look it up, you know, and on the broadcast and stuff. But
if you so desire.
Yep. But, you know, you never know. I mean, some of us, you know, our ascensions could have very long, lateral detours. You know, who knows what some of us might be doing. We might be hanging around more locally for a long span of time. You never know.
Suspend our Agendoner stance, corporeal presence on the planet.
I mean, definitely. And they talk about things getting back to normal, right? I mean, yeah. Then that full on Agendoner stuff is not in play anymore, right? When there's something to see, you can't. You're not believing without seeing anymore, right? Yeah.
Saying that the problems here on this world affected getting us into progression.
Yeah. Remember, the Melchizedeks have a whole college trying to deal with all the changes and all the issues. Yep.
they mentioned the Lucifer Rebellion. They call it the Caligastia Secession.
Right.
So he, as God of Urantia, the planetary prince, he, mm-hmm. he took the planet in a different direction, the ordained direction.
Yeah.
So as far as what he experienced, that he boiled down to a nutshell, was a crisis of faith. Caligastia.
Yeah. Yeah.
Here,
hold on.
Was to try to rekindle faith on your edge.
Yeah, I mean, it just, you know, a lot of times they say it very precisely like that to remind you that he isn't, you know, initiating a rebellion. He's joining a rebellion, you know.
Right.
He's seceding, you know.
It indicated in the Ancient Book that one of the things Lucifer wanted to do was accelerate time.
Right, he wanted to skip over steps, yeah. Yeah, yeah, like we talk about, that's what that secession is about, is, let's skip over all the normal developmental steps and just, by fiat, you know, go to the final step. And, as if you are the whole, as a part. You know, just one other little thing there about that last paragraph we read. When they're talking about the planet moving towards light and life, you know, when Urantia is approaching the year of light and life, yeah. Notice that, you know, they start talking about magisterial suns. It's not like you're near to it, okay? But the point there is, once you kind of get the boat anchor of the rebellion and the secession totally settled, and we sort of definitively start moving without that drag on the planet, yeah, we will be approaching, see, instead of kind of just hovering, you know, wishing we were, you know, moving in that direction. Yeah, that's what they're getting at there, the way they're wording that. So you don't get confused by that. You know, a magisterial son, having a magisterial son here means we're still a long, long ways away from light and life, even if everything is going splendidly. Right? Those ages take a long time. You know, and who knows, with our world and all the complications, we may have to have many magisterial sons, right? It may be a stepwise process, so it could be a long span of time before we get to the first Trinity teacher son. You know, and then you don't know how many Trinity teacher sons you might need to have. Yeah, it's we have a very complicated world. So, all right, let's keep going.
It has long been the opinion of our order that Machiaventa's presence on the Jerusalem core of Urantia directors, the 420 counselors, is sufficient evidence to warrant the belief that he is destined to follow the mortals of Urantia on through the universe scheme of progression and ascension, even to the paradise core of the finality. We know that Adam and Eve are thus destined to accompany their earth fellows on the paradise adventure when Urantia has become settled in light and life.
Right, see, so they even bring in that, it's like, you know, well, you know, which is kind of challenging the sort of forever, you know, we read a little bit ago, but again, they're just hedging all their bets. I mean, you know, that fact that he's amongst the 420, you could even speculate maybe at some distant point in the future, you know, he would become an ascender, right? See, and really become that, you know, kind of more in that mode of his soul, which is an ascending sort of a fact, right? See, yeah, so, you know, and then who knows what, you know, like I said, I mean, maybe you could speculate, maybe then some son they've never talked about in the Urantia book is brought in to be planetary prince or something. I mean, you can just speculate endlessly about the possibilities.
Chris,
yep.
Beings like him are modified in this way.
Mm-hmm.
It makes them really super unique or... like, yeah. Super beings like you can't imagine.
Yes, he's like descending and ascending at the same time, right? You know, and right, it's like, what is he? Yeah.
So it's cool, like his destiny is just ultra cool. Also.
Right. Yeah, and you can tell the universe just doesn't know. I mean, you know, as they heard, they say that as his was an emergency bestowal on Urantia, it does not appear from the records that Machaventa's future, what Machaventa's future may be. In other words, you can't just go, well, you know, there's been many things just like this, and the such and so happened to that one, and so that's what's going to happen to him. I mean, it just, you know, no one really knows. You know, and they're just telling you, you can look at it 50 different ways, you know, and end up with a different end result. I mean,
there's no precedent.
Yeah, it's just, yeah, you just, yeah. It's just, everything is a wild card. Not only the world, but some of the beings associated with the world.
So that's one of the reasons I want to stay associated and be part of what they're part of.
Yeah, yeah.
The whole thing is so unique.
It's such a glorious giant question mark, you know, if you're curious.
I'm asking. Please make me part of it.
Yep. Yeah, you know, and see that's gonna go with us. You know, even if you know we don't satiate our interest in question marks here with these issues, we're gonna be beings, ascenders, who you know are looking for those giant question marks a lot more than other beings from other worlds. You know, that's gonna go with us a long ways. Ooh, uncertainty. I love uncertainty. Right? All right. Now, okay, then we got this last little bit here.
Less than 1,000 years ago, this same Machaventa Melchizedek, the one-time sage of Salem, was invisibly present on Urantia for a period of 100 years, acting as resident governor general of the planet. And if the present system of directing planetary affairs should continue, he will be due to return in the same capacity in a little over 1,000 years.
Okay, so if the present system, right, okay, remember what the present system is you have 24 counselors, you know, even though they're not all permanent right now, you still have 24, you know, and they rotate being resident governor general, you know, every 100 years, and that started in AD 30, right? So the first one was from AD 30 to AD 130, et cetera, going forward, right? There'll be a shift in 2030. Okay, so now think about that, you know, as they're writing this, right? You're right around the time of 1930 when the resident governor general switched the last time. So, less than 1,000 years ago, he was the resident governor general for 100 years. Okay, well, that probably means that he was resident governor general from AD 930 to 1030. Right? Now, you go back 1,000 from 1930, you got 930, and see, less than that is the 100 years that he's resident governor general. And it's like, well, okay, if we start with that assumption that he was from 930 to 1030, how does that work with, you know, he'll come back around again in a little over 1,000 years? Okay, well, if, you know, he ends at 1030, then you got 2,300 years, 23 other guys to do their 100-year stints before he would come back around in the rotation, right? So that would be in 3330. And that's, you know, yeah, 1,400 years, right? A little over 1,000 years, you know, forward from, you know, when they were saying that. You know, not to mention, you know, you could, you know, even say that, you know, you're talking about, you know, a few years past, you know, 1930, you know, making it even, you know, even less up to 3330. So that seems to fit, you know, with the two numbers. You know, you've got the less than 1,000 and a little over 1,000 the other direction. I mean, see, obviously, if you shift it, you know, you start to get more than 1,500 years. It's like, well, is that really a little over 1,000? That's like pushing towards 2,000. You know? So that seems to work. That's probably what it was. He was probably here from 930 to 1030 as a resident governor general. And the other thing, just kind of aside from all that you know, interesting stuff about him. Can you challenge yourself to not be like Adam and Eve and think beyond 100 years? Right? Where, you know, it's just a completely irrelevant, tiny little chunk of time. A little over 1,000 years from now, he'll be back again. Right? Just between the lines is something for you, right? To just more eternalize your perspective about things. And that, you know, we want the world to be settled in light and life in our lifetime. You know, or you know, we're going to start screaming at God. You know, I mean, 3330, you know, is a triviality in the minds of the authors here. You know, for us, it's like 3330. you know, you have to, like I was saying about those dispensational epics. You know, go back and read that paper and remind yourself how long those are normally, all those. You know, how long a bestowal sun age is normally, and a magisterial sun age, and all of a sudden, you know, this is not, you know, something that happens overnight so that it can be there in your lifetime. You know, this requires hundreds of thousands of years, right? And no one thinks that's a long time on high. Right?
How long is a day on
earth? I mean, this Melchizedek has been writing this paper. Yeah, he's been around in the local universe for how long? Really long time, right?
Yeah. Yeah, 300
billion years old. Right, just all these
almost
things.
Almost a billion years.
Right. I mean, remember that, you know, the whole super universe level has been around for 300 trillion. So it's just, you know, but, you know, start with baby steps. 300 trillion is completely incomprehensible. I mean, just try to think of, you know, going to 3330, you know, and it not being any issue at all. Yep.
We only think it's a long time because of our inability to comprehend the enormity of the work that needs to be done.
Yeah.
If we're able to conscientize what had to be done, it was like, my God, well, it's not enough time, we'll never get it done.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I was trying to allude to. I mean, you know, we say, oh, Melchizedek receivers, all I have to do is like sit around and, you know, maybe they, you know, they tweak Ezekiel or something, you know. Like, no, I mean, there's, you can imagine how many tasks that aren't even remotely mentioned in the Urantia book that they're up to, right? I mean, they're not twiddling their thumbs at all. I mean, there's 100 million tasks in their daytime or every day, you know, I mean, none of that is talked about. I mean, wait until we get on high and get a little better perspective of just what's involved in getting a world of light and life. Like you're saying, you know, no one will be thinking, oh, well, that's just a straightforward thing.
Well, we're one and a half dispensations.
Yeah, and then there's all of that, too. Exactly right, yes. Okay, then one final little footnote here.
This is the story of Machiavento Melchizedek, one of the most unique of all characters ever to become connected with the history of Urantia, and a personality who may be destined to play an important role in the future experience of your irregular and unusual world. Presented by a Melchizedek of Nebadon.
And not just unusual, irregular and unusual. You know, remember the irregular part is just how it hasn't followed the normal, you know, order of things, you know, hardly at all. You know, and then it's just, you know, it's just kind of an innately unusual world, right, to begin with. Okay, so there we have it. There's Machiavento. And let's get into the Melchizedek missionaries heading out. Let's see what they have to say to us here.
Paper 94. The Melchizedek Teachings in the Orient. The early teachers of the Salem religion penetrated to the remotest tribes of Africa and Eurasia, ever preaching Machiavento's gospel of man's faith and trust in the one universal God as the only price of obtaining divine favor. Melchizedek's covenant with Abraham was the pattern for all the early propaganda that went out from Salem and other centers. Urantia has never had more enthusiastic and aggressive missionaries of any religion than these noble men and women who carried the teachings of Melchizedek over the entire Eastern Hemisphere. These missionaries were recruited from many peoples and races, and they largely spread their teachings through the medium of native converts. They established training centers in different parts of the world where they taught the natives the Salem religion and then commissioned these pupils to function as teachers among their own people.
Okay, so remember that little foreshadowing of talking about the missionaries, they reminded us they went everywhere, you know, in the Eastern Hemisphere. And how did such a vast enterprise get started? You can kind of see them referring to that. You know, you were asking about that earlier. You start with the handful of people that Machaventa trained himself, and he immediately then, you know, sending them out near to Salem, you know, in that immediate area, setting up some satellite centers, you know, and they're engaging people there, you know, and then sending them out. Right? So, you know, you just send it out in these waves. You know, it's not like you have a whole huge mass of people you trained at Salem and then those people went out. Not at all. It starts with just a mustard seed of people, right, in Salem. And notice how they're using kind of the old Dalmatian model, right? You kind of bring select individuals, you know, into the inner circle, train them up, and then they go out and really kind of spread the gospel.
Jesus did the same thing.
Yeah, right.
They didn't have the communication that we have today.
Yeah, right.
It's different.
Yeah. So these guys are all walking, you know, pretty much and stuff. And, you know, but, you know, no one has to go running. No one has to go at the speed of the internet or anything. I mean, you just let it move out in waves. Now, obviously, when you do this, you know, in such a heat, you know, these people hand it to these people and they hand it to these people and they hand it, you know, it's going to dilute, obviously, as it spreads out. Okay. But, you know, like you were just saying, there really isn't anything else that can happen back in those days. You don't have rapid transportation and communication like we do today. You know, a lot of people, you know, didn't really even use horses. I mean, you know, Jesus, you know, David Zebedee is sending runners, right? Not guys on horseback, you know, right? There's a key philosophic thing up front there. Remember how we stressed when we went through the five epical revelations that the key words for the third were trust and faith in that order, right? Because you're starting with that faith foundation and trying to build genuine soul trust on that spiritual faith foundation. And I told you that other places in the book, they flip it, right? Because you're trying to foster living faith, you know, instead of just that grasping, you know, desperate faith that's trying to antidote fear, right? You want to liberate it from fear so that you get trust as the foundation and have a living faith on top of that. See, you've got it here, faith and trust. See right there at the beginning? Okay. So, you know, in many ways, when these missionaries go forward, they're not just trying to start it up. Machaventa sort of started it up with a few, and then was really trying to foster, you know, the reciprocal of having a trust foundation and them going out with a living faith. You know, and inspiring others to a living faith, right? I mean, as the end goal, not just mere faith as the end goal. You see it right there. I mean, you know, it's not the mere faith of Jesus that's inspiring. It's the genuine living faith of Jesus, you know, where there is no fear. There's a trust foundation. Okay, so that's right there. And then the other thing is just, you know, that there haven't been more zealous, you know, aggressive proselytizers, okay? You know, maybe there's been equals, but never greater. Right? And just the fact of what they did, I mean, they went everywhere, like, the, you know, like we you know, they made it all the way to Iceland and stuff, remember, you know what I mean? Yeah, and Japan, and they went everywhere. It's a, you know, they penetrated all of Africa, right? So no matter how deep you are in the heart of Africa, they got there, you know. Whereas, you know, you're still maybe trying to filter, you know, Islam or Christianity into some of those areas. So very, very aggressive and enthusiastic, as they're saying, missionaries. Okay. And so without any ado, just that one little paragraph, and boom, we're going to jump right into India. Okay, and immediately going to be talking about all those local details.
One, the Salem teachings in Vedic India. In the days of Melchizedek, India was a cosmopolitan country which had recently come under the political and religious dominance of the Aryan Andite invaders from the north and west. At this time, only the northern and western portions of the peninsula had been extensively permeated by the Aryans. These Vedic newcomers had brought along with them their many tribal deities. Their religious forms of worship followed closely the ceremonial practices of their earlier Andite forebears, in that the father still functioned as a priest, and the mother as a priestess, and the family hearth was still utilized as an altar.
Okay, so first of all, let's just get ourselves set in the time frame a little bit. When they're saying India was a cosmopolitan country which had recently come under the political and religious dominance of the Aryan Andite invaders from the north and west. Remember, we're initially setting up the Indus Valley civilization, you know, in the area that's mostly Pakistan now. So if you go back, I'll just remind you, you know, back there in, you know, what paper is that? Paper 79, the Andite expansion in the Orient. You know, that's the predicate for what we're reading right now. When they're talking about the Aryan invasion of India, they say, the second Andite penetration of India was the Aryan invasion during a period of almost 500 years in the middle of the third millennium before Christ. The middle of the third millennium before Christ. This migration marked the terminal exodus of the Andites from their homelands in Turkestan. Okay, you know, so coming down into the Indus Valley region there. They're in the middle of the third millennium. So Makaventa, right, was, you know, back there, you know, around the, it came around the beginning of the second millennium, 1980 BC, right? He's there towards the beginning of the second millennium. So, you know, it's like they're saying.
No, it's the end of the second millennium.
Well, if you're thinking that way, it's the end. But, you know, going forward in time, it's the beginning of the second millennium before Christ. The biggest number of years before Christ, you know, in the second millennium. You know, so, you know, it's this invasion, see, has been there for a few centuries and gotten settled, you know, and it's, you know, relatively, you know, right in the wake of that kind of getting all spun up over those initial centuries that the Melchizedek missionaries are showing up there in the second millennium. Okay, so that's the situation, and if you, you know, if you look up, you know, when the Vedic texts, you know, were from, and you know, when the, you know, the height of the Indus Valley civilization, you know, was and stuff, you can see it basically fits what they're saying. I mean, the relatives are helping you, tweaking the dates a little bit for you to try to pin it down a little bit more precisely for us. But, you know, we basically kind of know, right, that this is when this stuff is happening. And this, you know, you've got a phenomenon that gets spun up, a Vedic culture, you know, that basically there is going along over that same span of when all this stuff is going on in Palestine with the Melchizedek receivers trying to keep the, you know, the pilot light lit, you know, with all the prophets and all that, right up until the 6th century B.C., when things change some there, just like they change some in the Near East. I see. So that all this stuff is going to happen over that same span of Old Testament time, as it were. Okay. Anything else there? Just that, you know, it's not just now that religion is complicated on the Indian subcontinent. It's been complicated for a long time. Those invaders were coming in, you know, as not as one mass, but many tribes, and they all had separate, you know, God notions. You know, it's very, very complicated, as they're about to explain a little bit more here. Yeah.
The Vedic cult was then in process of growth and metamorphosis under the direction of the Brahmin caste of teacher priests, who were gradually assuming control over the expanding ritual of worship. The amalgamation of the one-time 33 Aryan deities was well underway when the Salem missionaries penetrated the north of India.
Okay, so it's been long enough that, you know, the whole caste system is getting well established and the Brahmin priesthood is getting very solidified. And so the process of trying to bring some order in the midst of all this God notion chaos is in play. And so that's obviously helpful, because the Melchizedek missionaries, you know that their goal is to try to get people to think monotheistically. You know, how helpful is it that you already have kind of a coalescing phenomenon in play that hopefully they could just kind of foster, right? You know, to an ever better focus. So that's an encouraging sign. Now, as we'll see, there's elements to that also are working the other direction for bringing it into a nice tight monotheistic system. Let's see, anything else there? Just the fact that, you know, you have kind of just 33, that's a lot easier situation than what Muhammad faced, right, with the Arabs. You know, they had hundreds. Okay. So that obviously means, you know, there's fewer to start with. It's kind of coalescing to begin with. One could be hopeful that maybe they could foster this to something much more simplified. All right, what else do they say here?
The polytheism of these Aryans, representative degeneration of their earlier monotheism, occasioned by their separation into tribal units, each tribe having its venerated god. This devolution of the original monotheism and Trinitarianism of Andite Mesopotamia was in process of resynthesis in the early centuries of the second millennium before Christ. The many gods were organized into a pantheon under the triune leadership of Deesis Pitar, the Lord of Heaven, Indra, the tempestuous lord of the atmosphere, and Agni, the three-headed fire god, lord of earth, and the vestigial symbol of an earlier Trinity concept.
Okay, so they're reminding you that, you know, there's been this, remember the whole, when we were talking about the Andite migrations, you know, you're starting in Mesopotamia, But you've got the moving up into Turkestan and eventually ending up down here. There's all this, you know, distance from the source. The best of, like they're saying, a monotheistic and Trinitarian sort of revelatory beginning that is coming down from Adam and Eve. But because this is so far and so long, hence, it's tended to melt into relationship with the evolutionary peoples, with the Sangic races, and pick up all kinds of variations. But like they were saying before, it's coming together. They're just reminding here that this coming together is not really a synthesis; it's a resynthesis. Okay, and so that leads to, that adds a complicated element to it right there. You're not just taking kind of very distinct tribal deities and bringing them together. You're bringing together things that have, like they're saying, vestigial aspects to them. They're complicated in and of themselves. It's not just complicated because there's many, gods, quote unquote gods. But kind of going back to the positive side, notice that one as this is coming together, there's a tendency to kind of retriunize the picture, and so you're going to have a father-like individual, Dios Ptah, right, which literally means sky father. Dios, sky, Ptah, father. What did we say back, in the last paper when we were reading about Melchizedek? That was one of the main things that he was trying to do. They had all these in the plane, God, spirit, ghost notions, and he was trying to lift that up, to a more exalted monotheistic concept. I mean, that's inescapably going to be kind of a sky father when you lift, a god up like that. Okay. So you literally have Sky Father. Okay, you're going, ooh, wow, that's like perfect. I mean, they can just try to emphasize, Dios Ptah, as the Most High. Okay, but it's not going to be that easy, as we'll read here as we continue on. But I mean, that sounds kind of exciting that you literally have. Yeah, you literally have Sky Father.
The Lord of Heaven. That's...
Yeah, right. The Lord of Heaven. But like I was saying, it's literally Sky Father. And that's all the other Andites had a Sky Father too, right? Whether it's Zeus or whomever. A lot of them had in their language they had the exact same thing. They had two words, for a god, Sky Father. Yeah, see, exactly. See, that's what, you could say it looks hopeful that you could foster that. But notice what you've got here. So you've got a heaven one, and then you've got an atmosphere one. That's Indra, right? And all the tempests, right? God of the tempests, this tempestuous lord of the atmosphere. So you got, up above and then in the middle, and then you've got down on the earth. They've got Agni, and Agni is, right, I mean, that's like in Latin, we've got ignite, igneous. This is just the Sanskrit version of that Andite, right, of Agni, right, it means fire, with an A instead of an I, basically, it's just like the Latin, it's fire. But they're reminding, this isn't just a simple thing, right? In its original version, it was a three-headed fire god. And like they're saying, it's a vestigial symbol of the Trinity because those three heads. One is for heaven, one is for the atmosphere, and one is for earth. See, one is for fire, one is for lightning, and one is for the sun. Right? So the sun part, that's kind of the Sky Father thing again, and then right, the lightning thing, that's like Indra. See, and okay, but you know, you can obviously guess that, you know, that probably if you stay in this mode, Agni is going to end up with only one head instead of three in the depictions, you know, and it's just going to be the fire head and the lightning head and the sun head have disappeared. Right, because you've got other ones holding the atmosphere in the heavens. Right? Right, and you see that. I mean, Agni in various depictions has you know one or two or three heads, depending on where you are in the evolution of these notions. Okay, but it started out like the whole threefold thing is all just in that one individual. You know, and initially, you know, that's still there, but you're trying to bring in the heaven and the atmosphere, you know, so it's kind of confusing. It's like, don't we have duplication here? So you're going, I bet you it's not going to be as easy as I thought to get them to just focus on Dios Pitar, right, to be, you know, what you call the Most High, you know, they could say to them. The Melchizedek missionaries could say to the Indians, and you see that here. Just what I'm saying is they go on. You know, look what they say next about Agni.
Definite henotheistic developments were paving the way for an evolved monotheism. Agni, the most ancient deity, was often exalted as the father head of the entire pantheon. The deity father principle, sometimes called Prajapati, sometimes termed Brahma, was submerged in the theologic battle which the Brahmin priests later fought with the Salem teachers. The Brahmin was conceived as the energy divinity principle activating the entire Vedic pantheon.
Okay, so right, already your eyes are starting to glaze over, right? Okay, so see, step one is Agni, the most ancient, obviously, right, since it's got all three in it already, was often exalted as the father head. See, so even though you had Sky Father, you still have really the father head is Agni, so like which one, you know, is the real father? You know, because like I said, it's got this, you know, the third head, the sun head, that's, you know, that's kind of the father sort of a thing. And then on top of that, you know, kind of, you know, remember they have a tendency to not be quite as simplistic in just, you know, in a polytheism. They not only have multiple gods, you know, as sort of individuality concepts, but they have more abstract philosophic sort of concepts, principles, notions, ideas. Right, so they have kind of a deity father principle, you know, and that might have gotten kind of anthropomorphized, or personified, you know, and you might think of Prajapati as, you know, like a literal another god, or you could kind of think of it, see, more as a deity father principle, and what's coming in here. See, it's not so much like the sun or literally the Sky Father, but you know the literalness of Prajapati is basically creation lord, right? It's the creator concept. Remember, we talked about that before. That's another issue about whether or not people have the idea of their god being a creator at all. You know, let alone a creator of everything, say. Right, but see that the people in India, because you've got all this Andite influence, okay, they've got, you know, that creator concept in play too. And it's like, well, that's good. It's like, wait a minute, is that the father? Right? Is it Dios Pitar? Is it Agni? Is it Prajapati? And then wait a minute, we also have the Brahman. You know, and you can kind of distill that. into Brahma. Okay, well, or is that the Father? All right, see, it's not as simple as one might have hoped here. And again, see, the Brahman, you've got this kind of more abstract philosophic concept, as they're saying, it was conceived as the energy divinity principle activating the entire Vedic pantheon, right? See, they've got this sort of philosophic context that they put around deity individualities, And so you can actually start to have something kind of like in the Revelation, where you have some kind of amorphous I am concept thing, and you unpack, you distill out of that a first source and center. See, it's kind of in going from the Brahman to Brahma, if you make Brahma kind of literalized as a god, being, an individuality. Right. So you can see, it's like exactly what should the Melchizedek missionaries focus on? All right. There's just so many different ways, and if they try to focus on this, what about the people that really prefer Agni? As they focus on Dhyaspatar, what about the people who prefer Agni? They're going to immediately be in a theologic battle with them. Yeah, it's going to be complicated. Like they said there, there was a theologic battle, and it wasn't just kind of the possibilities because of all this diversity. You've got the Brahmin priesthood. And, as they pointed out, they've reached the level of a pretty exalted sense of themselves. And they're not going to appreciate someone coming in and telling them how it really is. The philosopher may not want to listen to you. The really zealous religionist will want to burn you at the stake. Right. Yeah. So, yeah, as they're about to point out, the Melchizedek missionaries not only have kind of a conceptual complexity here to deal with, but they've got the Brahmin priesthood that are not going to go peacefully into the night. All right, and we'll talk a lot more about the complexities of Brahmanism and Hinduism and whatnot as we go forward here. But let's look at what the missionaries faced here now.
The Salem missionaries preached the one God of Melchizedek, the Most High of Heaven. This portrayal was not altogether disharmonious with the emerging concept of the Father Brahma as the source of all gods, but the Salem doctrine was non-ritualistic and hence ran directly counter to the dogmas, traditions, and teachings of the Brahmin priesthood. Never would the Brahmin priest accept the Salem teaching of salvation through faith, favor with God, apart from ritualistic observances and sacrificial ceremonials.
As always, right, like it was with Jesus, right, and for the last 2,000 years, as it was with Machaventa, no one can get to just faith. It's like, no, there has to be works righteousness somehow or other. You have to actually move your body around or move molecules around in some way or something or other, right? You got to jiggle air molecules in a certain way. There's some ritual, there's some outer life scheme, right? And no one is willing to accept, that the God that Jesus, for instance, is trying to get you to relate to is a God with no outer life, a God with no outside, right? And relationship to him is purely in the inner life, is absolutely nothing to do with the external world, the outer life, with your body or any other thing in the external world, right? Right. The real God has no outside. Right. You're not going to find him in the outer life. He has no outer life to relate to your outer life.
Well, you search for the supreme in the lives of all those
That's different, you know, looking for, the shadow of supremacy afoot around you, yeah, in the external world. But the Universal Father, right, every being has an outer life except one, the Universal Father. The Eternal Son, because he's the Eternal Mother of the Son, has an outer life. The Infinite Mother Spirit has an outer life. The Universal Father has no outer life. He has no outside. And now, if you picture his mind in the hourglass analogy, he has no lower domain. He has only an upper domain. He's the only being like that. He has no lower domain. He has no associating mechanism to the external world. Okay? That's the stuff they teach you up in papers 1 through 5. This is not your father's God, right? That they're introducing you to there.
And he is the main goal. That's why it's so important.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you should seek first the kingdom of heaven, your genuine inner life, because you need to start with a God nucleus. And there is no God to be found in the outer life. But, all of mankind throughout a million years doesn't have the real God. They have the ghost cult God notion, a God with an outer life of some sort, right? A Christian God is a God with an outer life. It's not the real God. That's just a notion, right? There isn't anyone that believes in a God that has no outside. That's a revelatory concept of the Universal Father. Right? So, but it doesn't mean that believing in a God with an outside is bad. I mean, did Machiavelli say, we need to execute anyone who believes in a God that has an outer life? No, he's basically preaching a God with an outer life. It's baby steps. It's like, your God is still going to have an outer life, but it's just going to be a little bit higher. So let's lift it up. Let's make his outer life a little less absurdly primitive, and anthropomorphic. So let's not have him playing around in the plane. Let's have his outer life be up, above, right? And so you don't really, you've never seen the outside up there, you don't really know. So, you don't fixate on the doings of his outer life up there. You don't know what they are to fixate on him. See, so it indirectly gets you to look for him, in the inner life, because you can't imagine the outer life to try to find him there in some mystical way, right? It's an indirect way of backing you into the real God, what Machiavelli and others, Jesus even, was doing. But anyway, back to this, notice that all that complexity is of kind of possible ones that they could lift up, Dios Pater or whatever, they notice that they say the concept of the Father Brahma. So like we pointed out, the one that's... as long as they've got kind of a Father God notion that has a little bit of a philosophic predicate to it, that one obviously has a little bit more potential. That's maybe that can get you a little bit closer to the genuine Universal Father. So when all is said and done, you don't really pick Agni or Dios Pater, here. Because you can say, okay, let's think about coalescing a one God, that's the basic essence of the Brahman. Think of coalescing that, right? And that's the monotheistic God. They could, that's where they could go. And remember that he's a creator, like you've played with that idea, right? He's not just, sort of the exaltation of your tribal archetype or something, right? He's a creator being. So that's where they needed to go and were probably trying to go. But the Brahmin priesthood is just not going to have anything of this, right? And again, it's mainly because the only valid righteousness is works righteousness, you know. And you're not going to tell me that ritualistic observances and sacrificial ceremonials aren't part of reality, you know. Everyone knows that we are born in debt, and you've got to do all kinds of things to get yourself out of debt, right? Just like they basically, when all is said and done, said to Jesus. It's like, no, what you're saying, Jesus, is foolishness, right? Everyone knows we're born in debt, right? The only way you even make sense is that you're the means of getting us out of debt, but we can't quite really hold on to that. We still end up thinking that you're in debt, and we still need to have this sacrificial sort of notion and whatnot. I mean, humans just can't get themselves out of that ghost cult framework that's predicated on debt, you know, as a foundational belief instead of gift. Right? Right? I mean, that's what. Yeah, Martin Luther was trying to do. It's like, wait a minute, there's getting way too much focus on debt. You know, we got coins and coffers ringing and everything, and you know, sort of literalizing this. What about grace? What about gift? Right? All right, so problems, you know, when all is said and done, the big problem is the Brahmin priesthood. So how does this play out?
The rejection of the Melchizedek gospel of trust in God and salvation through faith marked a vital turning point for India. The Salem missionaries had contributed much to the loss of faith in all the ancient Vedic gods, but the leaders, the priests of Vedism, refused to accept the Melchizedek teaching of one God and one simple faith.
See, so India could have been on a path that would have been much more receptive to subsequent things. But, you know, as we know, you know, it instead just became so, you know, now you basically have a religion, Hinduism, where there's a flavor of it for each Hindu. You know, it's gone to the complete opposite of monotheism, basically, right? Near infinite complexity and specialization. And it's all because of those, stuck in the mud, you know, Brahmin priests. So, you know, when you talk about in the Old Testament about the Hebrews, you speak of as hard-hearted, and it just, you can't move them off that mark. But the people, see, were going for it. And see, of course, that just, you know that incensed the Brahmin. You know, they're losing their power. It's like, you're taking my power base away. You know, that's how my whole sense of self-worth is based upon power over others. You know, they weren't going to have anything of it. What was that?
Reminds me of another story.
Yeah, that's right, yes. Someone else's power base was being threatened, yes. You know.
And it's not ancient.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and yeah, that's what happens today. You know, someone is persona non grata because he's threatening the establishment's power base. That's just the way it works. I know. Obviously, you're talking about Jesus, but again, just yeah, it's a story that's just everywhere and always has been. And notice that they even pointed out. See, the more it gets fixated in the priesthood, it isn't sort of just a Vedic culture; it's Vedism. You've got this ism. So good luck trying to evolve it once it's ismized. All right, one final paragraph here.
The Brahmins culled the sacred writings of their day in an effort to combat the Salem teachers. And this compilation, as later revised, has come down to modern times as the Rig Veda, one of the most ancient of sacred books. The second, third, and fourth Vedas followed as the Brahmins sought to crystallize, formalize, and fix their rituals of worship and sacrifice upon the peoples of those days. Taken at their best, these writings are the equal of any other body of similar character in beauty of concept and truth of discernment. But as this superior religion became contaminated with the thousands upon thousands of superstitions, cults, and rituals of southern India, it progressively metamorphosed into the most variegated system of theology ever developed by mortal man. An examination of the Vedas will disclose some of the highest and some of the most debased concepts of deity ever to be conceived.
Right. So like so many of those things, you know, there's an initial and hence kind of a core, you know, true, beautiful, and good, like they're kind of saying, aspect to it. But there's also the most grotesque stuff that's gotten, you know, mixed in with it. Now, you know, notice this interesting little bit of clarification of where the Vedas came from, where the four Vedas came from, you know, particularly the Rig Veda. So they take all of their sacred writings that they had way back then, we have no clue of anymore, right? Way back then, they call them, you know, all in a reactionary effort to make Vedism this very definitive challenge and make it unassailable to the Salem missionaries. Yeah, the fact that that's why the Rig Veda exists is a reactionary product because of the Melchizedek missionaries, see? Oh, yeah? But notice the parallel. Like I said, all this time, the time of all this, you know, it's paralleling the whole Old Testament, you know, leading up to the 6th century B.C. Okay, with the Hebrews, right, when they're in exile during the 6th century B.C., that's when they cull all of their writings and put together what we call the Old Testament, their sacred book. They did the exact same thing here. They culled all their writings and put forward this definitive thing, you know, about which the people could orbit and not, you know, fly off in diffusing tangents into everyone around them, right? That could keep them grounded to the one true faith, quote unquote. Right? So very parallel phenomenon, you know, in that regard.
Cultures in a way did the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
They added a lot to it, but still.
Yeah. Right. But it wasn't in this kind of reactionary mode. See, and that's it's an action, and you know, the Urantia book is an action, you know, culling our writings, not a reaction. Right. And not this for, you know, basically selfish motivation behind the reactionary product, where it's all about you. You want it to be all about you. And you know, just like when they, you know, eventually when we talk about Buddhism, you know, you have this very unfortunate aspect that it ranges from the delightfully, brilliantly sublime, on the one hand, to the most primitive, debased, grotesque thing on the other hand, and for those that treat that, you know, every word of that as a sacred text, and hence you cannot differentiate between anything in it. I mean, you don't really have the truth, beauty, and goodness. Right, it becomes debased by association because you have to think about those potentially proper nuggets in a way that they're somehow in synchronization with the debased things. So you pollute them, you debase them in association, and you just there's no way for you to liberate yourself from the bondage of all that garbage, you know. No matter how devout you are, no matter how earnest you are.
In a strange way, the higher and more true things pull you in.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost like being seduced by the truth.
Yeah.
And then the more you focus and try to get into the details, the more lost you
Yeah. It's insidious. It ends up being kind of a sophistry.
Yeah.
You know, there's this spiritual candy that lures you in, but then you swallow all the dead man's bones, you know, all the debasement at the same time. Yeah, very unfortunate. You know, and just a near hopeless situation. It's like to try to somehow know the truth and be set free from such extensive bondage. It's like, how is it going to happen? And, you know, it's a very problematic situation to liberate those people from this dogmatic bondage. All right. As you see, we're going to get into Brahmanism next time. Because basically, we kind of have already seen how this is going to go with the Melchizedek missionaries. But like I said way back, you know, they use these papers about the Melchizedek missionaries to give us some basic unpacking of the religions that move forward to the present time, you know, like we were reading about, you know, at the end of the evolutionary religion papers. So, we'll move into, you know, some of the details of Hinduism and whatnot eventually here. Okay, let's take a moment here, everyone.